This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools will start the new year with a new superintendent and in the aftermath of a new pupil assignment plan, but CMS students haven't returned to the classroom quite yet. But other schools around the area and around the state are back in session, so we're going to use this as a very good reason to take stock of the challenges ahead in this academic year. Andos Helms is the Charlotte Observer's longtime education reporter. She's back with us in our Spirit Square studio, along with Liz Bell, a reporter for Education NC. That's an online newspaper about all things education in the state that you can find at ednc.org, and she joins us by phone. Liz, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome, and Anne, welcome back.
Thanks.
You're here all the time.
I was going to say, I'll be disoriented because it will feel like Friday now.
That's right. You take the rest of the week off. yesterday evening, and this was in the paper this morning, Charlotte Mecklenburg School Board, you said, celebrated, that's a great word to use, a budget that includes raises for its more than 19,000 employees. Why the word celebrated? Did they not see this coming?
Of course they did see it coming, because they don't really have the power to say we're going to grant this amount of raise because they don't have taxing authority. So what they do is follow and watch, which I'm really glad we have Liz who understands what they're doing in Raleigh, because, boy, it's confusing from a distance. But we knew that they had approved a state budget that included raises of about averaging about 3.3% for teachers, which is always the one that gets a lot of attention, 7% for school-based administrators, which is basically principals and assistant principals, for the non-certified staff, you know, all the people who do non-educational things, either 3% or $1,000, whichever is higher, and for the much-needed bus drivers, which CMS is still trying to recruit as that opening day approaches, $1,500 raise. So
for the year.
For the year, yeah.
So I was going to ask you about that. We're not going to spend a lot of time on CMS because we're going to have Superintendent Clayton Wilcox on the program a little bit later on this month, and we'll spend the whole hour on him and on CMS. But every year it seems that at the last minute they're scrambling to find enough teachers and enough bus drivers. Is that the case this year?
It is. There are 155 teacher vacancies that don't even have some, you know, there are some that are just finishing the paperwork, but 155 true openings, which sounds horrifying. Again, it's out of a teacher workforce of almost 9,000.
Right.
So they're saying it's about average for this time of year. This happens, you know, districts are recruiting CMS teachers and CMS is recruiting teachers from other districts. So there's always this last minute shuffle.
So this happens all over the state, Liz. This is not common only to Charlotte Mecklenburg schools.
Definitely. And, you know, teacher pay year after year at the state level is a priority on both sides of the aisle. Often both parties are kind of competing to see whose plan is better. This year, the final budget added $700 million to public education. And as Anne said, that included an average teacher salary increase of 3.3% this year and 9.6% over the biennium. It's always a big talking point on both sides of the aisle.
Okay. And Clayton Wilcox also, he's our new superintendent, for those of you who are not keeping score. You don't have the home version of this broadcast. Clayton Wilcox still has not filled a few of his key top positions, among them communications director, if I'm not mistaken. And some of those positions that have been filled and have been held by certain people have only been renewed for 1 year as opposed to 3 years. Is that causing dissension in the ranks, tension in the ranks? Is it making it more difficult to retain people, to attract people?
I think it's fair to say that it's probably a pretty tense place to work right now. When you have some people who have been told, you know, 4-year contract, you know, we're good with you, and some people have been told 2-year because we want the option to kind of keep revamping, and then you have kind of all these people who are on the front lines that have been told 1-year contract,
right,
which is pretty disconcerting.
He has said
that he is looking to reorganize and streamline, which is, again, not surprising to see a new superintendent do that. I think maybe the way it's been done and the way some people are finding out about these things, there's probably a lot of feeling of, you know,
right,
your long-term future is not secure here necessarily.
So that's to give him flexibility, so he's not locked into somebody for 4 years that he doesn't think is suited for whatever he wants to accomplish.
Right, and he may just, it may not even be about an individual's performance. It may be about the structure they have, where they have several different groupings of schools, reporting to one person. Guilford County Schools recently did a reorganization along those lines. And I think, you know, when we saw that in the paper, a lot of us were looking at that and saying, is this potentially going to be a model for how Clayton Wilcox is trying to put the emphasis on the schools and maybe streamline what a lot of people view as bureaucracy in the central offices? Although, as we talk about charter schools, we may see that, you know, there are some advantages and disadvantages to having that big central office staff.
So in recent years, there's been a push toward providing vouchers to pay for private school educations. It was reported recently that in North Carolina, where taxpayer money is being used for that purpose, some of the families using these vouchers are struggling to cover all of the financial costs of that private education. Who's this most affecting, Liz?
So the General Assembly has made a concerted effort to not only expand vouchers or what they call opportunity scholarships, but also signal that they intend to continue to expand the program. This year they allocated $44.8 million, which is set to increase by $10 million each year over the next 10 years. So families are obviously being affected by this new school environment and this new option in the education space. The study that you pointed out is interesting because it reminds us that there are factors outside of the classroom, like transportation, that are just as important as those inside when it comes to the health and achievement of North Carolina students.
For people who aren't familiar with this program, it might help to explain it. The opportunity scholarships are $4,200 a year for families who fit within the income guidelines, basically low to moderate income. And it's not designed to pay for a family that's already settled into private school. It's either kids who are just arriving in school or who are switching from public to private schools. So $4,200 for anybody who shopped for private schools will cover most of the tuition at some schools. Mostly, the vast majority of recipients are religious schools.
Right.
And you have some smaller church schools.
And you go to Country Day for $4,200 a year?
No, you cannot. That's over $20,000. And I don't believe they even participate. I think the big, elite, selective schools in Charlotte and Raleigh, and I don't know how many, just don't even participate. And it wouldn't really matter if they did because it's such a small fragment of, and that's one thing to remember with this when you start trying to say, talk about comparing performance, which they're not really doing yet, but it's going to be hard to do. Even if my child gets an opportunity scholarship and I say that I want to go to, say, Trinity Episcopal, which I think does participate, that doesn't mean they have to take my child. You know, that you can still, as a private school, use whatever kind of screening you want, whether it's showing that you're academically ready, whether it's that you subscribe to the religion. Some of them actually say we don't accept families that are practicing homosexuals, you know, and that's been a point of contention. But this is different from a public school in that you're getting less money. The $4,200, one reason that this is viewed as a good deal for taxpayers is that that's less than half of what you spend per pupil on a charter or a district school. So in theory, if my child wants to go to a private school and I'm willing to pay some of it because you're almost always going to end up paying some costs, then they'll write you the check for $4,200 and consider it a good deal.
Well, I wasn't going to get into this, but that opens a whole other can of worms. If they're giving you $4,200 to go to a private school and the private school will accept that as the full tuition, the full freight.
No, they don't have to accept that.
If that's what it costs to go to that school and they will accept that voucher, and that's half of what it costs to put somebody in a public or a charter school, which is also a public school.
Right.
Why is it half? How can they afford to do it? What kind of an education are you getting for half the amount?
Well, that's a great question, and there's no real way to measure it. Liz, you may know.
Yes. When you're talking about comparing performance, which I think is a concern that a lot of people have had, you know, holding private schools accountable that are receiving taxpayer money, there's actually another study that the results haven't come out yet out of NC State that is comparing the academic outcomes of voucher students to public school students with a standardized test called the Iowa test. So that will be interesting to see the results of and hopefully provide some answers to people wondering if this private environment is making a difference for these children who wouldn't otherwise have the opportunity to have that kind of education.
Could the fact that they can do it for half of what it costs to do it in the public schools account for the lack of overhead at a private school? I mean, the overhead at CMS is enormous.
Yeah, I mean, it could be anything from they're just using a room in the church mm-hmm. to they don't necessarily have to have teachers who meet the same licensure requirements. They don't need to offer the same range of curriculum.
So getting back to the fact that these people who are receiving these vouchers are suddenly finding that perhaps it's not affordable for them. They're discovering that it's not affordable because, yes, that pays the tuition, but then there are other costs like transportation, et cetera, that they haven't figured in, and so it becomes unaffordable for them even though they've already committed to this. Why is that a surprise?
I don't think it is. Every year there's been sort of, they offer a certain number of scholarships, and if you apply, the first thing they do is see if you're actually eligible, and if you are, they tell you, yes, you're eligible, but a fair number of those people who are told they qualify then don't actually end up following through. And they just sent out a press release this morning saying that this is the first year that they're going into a school year fully subscribed. They've got about 8,300 statewide scholarships issued. Many of those are students who got them because once you get in, if you stay and you continue to meet the requirements, you keep getting that $4,200 a year. So they're saying they've had their highest rate of return. About 90% of last year's scholars are back in the program. They've got new students. And again, that the money is there and it's scheduled to keep growing.
So are the people of the 8,000 people who are receiving these vouchers, Liz, are the ones who are having trouble with transportation and food costs and other parts of their personal budgets that make this unaffordable? Are they the minority of these 8,000 people?
I don't know that specific percentage, to tell you the truth. This right now is obviously a priority for at the state level, but that doesn't necessarily mean that another General Assembly couldn't come in and change all of that. But that does mean that this legislature thinks, you know, choice is important, not only in the charter school setting, but in the private school setting as well.
And that leads to a question about why they think choice is important. There have been suspicions on the part of many people, particularly in public education, that all this push toward charter schools, toward vouchers, et cetera, is because they want to weaken the public schools or destroy the public schools in some cases, in some people's minds. These vouchers have had one success. They have helped private schools who have been experiencing declining enrollment to stave some of that off. Was that an unintended consequence, or was that one of the intended consequences of this voucher program?
Liz, do you want to field that since you know more about the people who are putting these programs in place?
I don't know if that was an intended consequence or not, but I will say that I think the idea of choice and parental choice is here to stay. The charter movement has taken root, and many legislative leaders have gotten behind it, and it's important, I think, to remember that only 6% of North Carolina students are in charter schools, and obviously a smaller percent are receiving vouchers. So, I think that public schools and traditional public schools and charter schools and even private schools face a lot of the same types of issues. One trend we've seen at the state level is a desire for the same kind of flexibility with scheduling, curriculum, and staffing.
And let me stop you there, Liz. We have to take a break. Liz Bell with Education NC. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Asheville Wine and Food Festival, a culinary weekend with globally inspired cuisine from over 80 vendors, chefs, wineries, and more, August 18th and 19th. Tickets at AshevilleWineAndFood.com. And McElveen Family Law, with 30 years combined experience helping couples and families through the process of divorce, custody, and alimony. Details at GoMcElveenFamilyLaw.com/NPR. The most affordable housing in town may be the homes people have lived in for years, but in some areas, those homes are being threatened by gentrification. As developers cater to the desire of so many people who want to live close in, the character of neighborhoods is changing, and that is pricing out some longtime residents. We look at that and at a first of its kind, what may be a first of its kind effort in Charlotte that holds the promise of success in helping to slow gentrification tomorrow at 9 on this program.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Google fires the engineer who wrote the company-wide memo saying women don't advance in tech because of biology. Now there's a storm. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks. Here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about education here and around the state today as kids go back to school in some areas. They're already back. Liz Bell is with us, reporter for Education NC. That's an online education newspaper. EdNC.org is where you'll find it. Ann Doss Helms is here. She's the education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. I had to stop you in the middle of a sentence. Liz, do you want to finish that or should we move on?
Well, the thing that I was referencing was, you know, a similar desire from traditional charter schools, traditional public schools, excuse me, and charter schools for flexibility and an ability to try new things to meet students' needs. There's a status at the state level called a restart status that continually low-performing public schools can apply for that give them flexibility when it comes to curriculum, staffing, and scheduling. That is one similarity. I think a lot of times we're focused on the differences between public charters and public traditional schools, but that's one interesting trend we've seen a lot of public schools apply for at the state level.
And you had mentioned this idea of it propping up private schools, and the vast majority of these students who are getting opportunity scholarships are kind of scattered around at schools that do not have a huge number of students. So it's a relatively small amount of their revenue. You do have some schools that are doing quite a lot with this. Trinity Christian School of Fayetteville last year pulled in $684,000 from the opportunity scholarships. The largest one in our area is Victory Christian Center School of Charlotte, about $327,000. So there are schools that rely very heavily on the state funding, and there are, I think, some additional reporting requirements for them. But in most cases, it's relatively small schools with relatively small numbers of subsidized students.
Opponents of vouchers, when the idea first surfaced, said that they were an attack on public education. Has that proven to be the case? No?
Well, it depends on who you're talking to. I think that people who are proponents of traditional public education do feel like the increase in charter schools and the increased funding for vouchers, that that is money that's not going into the schools that are there and have to take every student who comes. If you try Victory Christian School or whatever private school and you decide it doesn't work, you can always go back to Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools. If you try one or two or three charter schools and they don't work for you, you can always go back to Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools. But the money that's going elsewhere, one group of people would say, is money that is being diverted from that communal institution.
But even if you have 8,000 students on full scholarship, what is that, $320,000 statewide? Or maybe it's $3 million, too. I can't do the math.
It's a much bigger amount, I can't do it without a calculator
right.
Either.
Teacher pay. Let's talk about teacher pay. That's a perennial topic when we talk about education. Where did teacher pay land as the budget worked its way through the state and through the county here? Liz, take the state point of view here. They did okay this year, teachers?
Yes. Well, I would say that, as I said, teacher pay year after year is a talking point and a priority. This year, they landed at about a 3.3% increase, average increase over this year, and a 9.6% increase over the next 2 years. For a comparison, Governor Cooper's plan would have raised the average salary by 5%. over each of the next 2 years. Now, critics have said that that plan would have done more for teachers. His salary schedule provided raises at every level of experience. I would say, and another thing at EdNC that we've been focused on is actually principal pay, which we, for a long time in North Carolina, were at the very bottom of the country on. And the General Assembly made some positive gains this year, giving an 8.6% salary increase over 2 years to principals and a 13.4% average increase over 2 years to assistant principals. And that also includes a bonus program. So the North Carolina Association of School Administrators has supported this move to valuing principals and said it could even lead to high-quality principals taking on struggling schools, which is a very important component of turning around a low-performing school.
So percentages can be deceiving. You get a 3.3% teacher pay raise, which is what happened here in Mecklenburg County. What does that mean? How much money is that?
Well, it totally depends on where you are on the experience scale.
Exactly.
And that's, you know, there's the state scale, and then the county, most counties add a supplement to that. And Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools certainly adds a significant supplement. One of the things that was floated during the budget discussions was whether the school board should go to the county commissioners and ask for an additional large pot of money to make that supplement bigger. And that request was not made. I think that's always going to be floating out there. Mm-hmm. I am intrigued by the bonus programs. And I was not totally aware of that until the school board presentation last night, that not only is there a bonus program based on test scores for principals, but they're expanding this bonus program for some teachers who have tested subjects based on what kind of growth their students show. And again, that's designed to make that open to kids, to teachers whose children start out below grade level. It's not supposed to be an automatic advantage for the teachers who have high-performing kids walking in the door, but it's still very controversial. When they awarded the first bonuses this past year, mm-hmm. obviously everybody's happy to see good teachers getting significant rewards, but there was a whole lot of questioning of why this teacher and not that teacher.
Right, and actually at the state level we're seeing a pilot program that is experimenting with differentiating teacher pay in different districts. So that's going to be really interesting to see how it affects teacher performance, teacher effectiveness, and also the relationships and the culture of schools.
And CMS, as I understand it, was one of six districts in the state awarded grants for systems that pay teachers for results and leadership rather than just experience and credentials. Is that correct?
It is.
And you reported recently, Anne, that this is what state leaders want, and they're looking to CMS to show them how. Why? Why CMS?
Well, Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools started this about 4 years ago with support from a number of private foundations. And what they're experimenting with is this is not something that's designed to reward everybody across the board, but it is designed for a school to say, here's a way that we can really put a high-performing teacher to use. So that sort of the performance part comes to from even being considered for this. You have to have proven results with your test scores, and then you would take on a job anywhere from maybe just working with technology to teach a few more students, and you might get an extra $1,500 a year to you can get as much as $20,000 a year extra. And there are teachers who are really seeing significant pay increases and career ladders. They might be overseeing a team of, say, three or four other colleagues who have their own classrooms. So that teacher leader, and I may not have the exact term right, but that highly paid, still in the classroom teacher is also coaching and supervising other adults, maybe spending some time in their classrooms, but not being the sole teacher in front of the kids. And we do know that this has taken shape. They've been expanding the schools. There have been a number of polls of the faculty saying we do or don't like these things about it. What we still don't have, to my knowledge at this point, is that kind of very complicated research that would say we know that doing this
works,
can turn around a school or can make this much difference for these kids.
And you report that performance pay tends to be popular among politicians and controversial among teachers. Why? Because there's the potential here of a teacher making a lot more money than they already make, and it seems to be a win-win situation where it's working. The teacher wins, the students win. Why is it controversial? Because it's not being paid on experience and credentials?
Yeah, there's always kind of that view that if we have money to pump into teachers, we should be doing across-the-board raises. And, you know, I would guess within any school there are mixed opinions about whether they picked the right person, whether that is making enough difference. You know, it's always one of those things that at the 50,000-foot level, everybody agrees that the best teachers should be paid better.
Right.
It's when you start trying to define the best teachers and attach the money to it that we start wrangling.
One of those people at the 50,000-foot level is Senate Leader Phil Berger. Under the normal system, teachers have been paid on degrees and certifications and longevity in the classroom, something he calls a ball and chain, because it can take teachers 30 years to reach the top of the pay scale. So, once again, why wouldn't teachers want an opportunity to make more money sooner?
Well, and some clearly do.
Teachers do. And as Ann was talking about those different opportunities that in CMS that teachers are having to still stay with students, but take on more leadership, take on more responsibility, and reach more students, that approach is in a lot of places being called an opportunity culture. And it has been implemented in a couple different districts around the state as well, namely in Edgecombe County, which in the rural eastern North Carolina, it's been a very, so far, appealing thing for teachers to come to that part of the state, which is a lot of times a struggle to be able to offer teachers as, you know, an appealing deal. Or one that compares with, a deal that can come out of either Wake County or CMS.
Going back, before we move on to something else, but going back to why it costs more to educate a student in the public schools than it might in a private school, Eric Davis, who is from the school board.
State and local school boards.
Yes, emails us that the primary drivers that raise the average per pupil cost of public schools is the cost for exceptional special needs children, which is $30,000 or more around that area, and educating poor children, which is around $10,000. So private schools don't have these costs. So that takes up the average cost of educating a child in the public schools. Liz, earlier this year, the legislature shifted some authority from the State Board of Education to the state superintendent. House Bill 17 made the state superintendent, Mark Johnson, the chief authority of the Department of Public Instruction, a role previously held by the state board. The Board of Education filed suit, but a three-judge panel ruled in July in Johnson's favor, and now the State Board of Education is appealing that decision. What is this all about, and what will it mean going forward?
So this lawsuit is important because it's asking a question many people wonder when it comes to North Carolina's educational system, which is, who is in charge? You know, we have over 100 different public school districts with local school boards. We have the state legislature, the State Board of Education, the state superintendent, the governor, and so it's a question that comes up pretty often. And I think it's also important to recognize that this isn't the first time similar constitutional questions when it comes to the board and the superintendent's relationship have been asked. In 2009, former State Superintendent June Atkinson sued then-Governor Bev Perdue over Perdue's appointment of more or less the CEO of the state school system. And the court came down in favor of Atkinson. So Atkinson had similar concerns as Johnson now has, that she didn't feel like she had the authority necessary to do her job. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, how this affects their working dynamic moving forward and who actually is in charge of all public schools and who is in charge of the Department of Public Instruction as well.
And Liz, do you have a good sense of what this means to schools out there? Because, you know, a lot of this, the power jockeying in Raleigh sometimes, I deal with it in terms of trying to figure out who I'm going to call to get accountability data or financial data or that kind of thing. But how does that trickle out to the actual schools? Do they care whether it's Mark Johnson or the state board?
I don't know about how much individual schools care, but I do think it's important for, the people of North Carolina to have a clear answer on who they can turn to and who they can hold accountable for what's coming out of Raleigh.
Well, let's talk about the structure of this. I mean, we have a state superintendent of education, Mark Johnson. We have a board of public education or public instruction, or whatever they call it. Why do we have two entities operating separately?
And we have a General Assembly, which is really making a lot of the decisions.
Yes, they make a lot of decisions. Yeah. They inject themselves into education a lot. But why do we have these two entities that supposedly are set aside to run the public school statewide or supervise the public school statewide, but they're at odds with each other, and they're not – why isn't he the head of the board?
And I hope Liz can explain this. I want to add just one more twist to this. It's the exact opposite of what we see locally, where the school board is elected and the superintendent is hired.
Right.
In this case, you have an appointed state school board and an elected state superintendent. So, Liz, please make sense of this for all of us.
Well, it definitely is confusing, and I think that's the reason that this lawsuit is not the first of its kind. You know, since a 1995 law said that the state board kind of could give whatever powers it deemed necessary to the state superintendent, the dynamic between the two and the powers that the state superintendent has had have kind of ebbed and flowed depending on who's in power. So I can't tell you exactly
is there politics involved here? I mean, is Mark Johnson, if he's elected, he's elected by the voters, and the board is appointed by whom? The governor or by the legislature?
Both, right? There are some appointees from the legislature.
So is this a Democrat-Republican rift? Is that what this is?
I believe you've hit on it.
So Mark Johnson is a Republican who was elected last year and replaced a longtime Democratic incumbent, June Atkinson, decades-long in the role and in the Department of Public Instruction. And so some people have said that, you know, politics are part of it. But I think it's interesting, too, that, as I said a few years ago, Atkinson was in a similar position and, as a Democrat, wanting some more clarification on her authority and It's not just politics is what I'm trying to say.
Okay, because Mark Johnson says there has been a lack of clarity about leadership at the Department of Public Instruction, which has fostered a system of non-accountability. What does he mean by that? Is there any evidence of
that? Well, I think from what Liz just said, yes. I think that is a fact, that there has been a lack of clarity about who's in charge of what.
What about accountability?
Well, that does become an interesting question, that who ultimately holds the responsibility. If you don't like what the State Department of Public Instruction is doing, who they've reported to has changed back and forth. I think we're going to talk some about charter schools, and that's one where the lines of authority have been changing quite a bit. The Office of Charter Schools used to report to the State Board of Education. It now reports to Mark Johnson. You also get into that philosophical thing of whether government is the solution or the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And again, June Atkinson was very either knowledgeable or entrenched, depending on how you want to put it. She had a long history of working with state government and the Department of Public Instruction. Mark Johnson just got elected. Young has been a teacher and a local school board member, but very new to state government.
We are going to talk about charter schools. That's coming up when we come back with Ann Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer and Liz Bell from Education NC. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Carolina Neurosurgery and Spine Associates, providing listeners a choice for brain and spine care, welcoming physician and self-referred patients to 7 area offices as permitted by insurance. Details at carolinaneurosurgery.com. And Bojangles, celebrating 40 years in Charlotte with 5 biscuit combos featuring the Bojangles made-from-scratch buttermilk biscuits, available all day, every day at area Bojangles. Well, coming up next on Point, Google fires the engineer who wrote the company-wide memo saying women don't advance in tech because of biology. Now, there's a story. The Google memo and gender in tech on Point coming up in 20 minutes. at 10 o'clock. And if you'd like to join our conversation about education, do so. CharlotteTalks at WFAE.org. Send us an email. You can search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at CharlotteTalks. And we're coming right back.
The news can shift these days on a dime.
In his statement on Twitter, President Trump said that the military
Senate rejected legislation to dismantle Obamacare by one
vote. You want to grasp how the South is changing, and you want to do that through food, no better place to show up than Charlotte.
When it does, NPR reports what we know, and we chase after what we don't. We take the time for another question to look ahead and get at what the news means right now. Stand with the facts. Listen every day.
News you can trust from 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about education as kids go back to school or prepare to go back to school, depending upon where you live. And Helms is here, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Liz Bell is with us from Education NC. That's an online, all things education newspaper, online at ednc.org. Before we talk about charter schools, let's talk about ESSA. The Every Student Succeeds Act, which replaced the No Child Left Behind Act, and it leaves much of the specifics of how every student can succeed up to the states. September is the deadline for North Carolina to file, our plan with the federal government. Where do we stand, Liz?
So members of the State Board of Education, Department of Public Instruction officials, and education stakeholders from around the state have been working on the specifics of this plan, which includes what indicators are going to reflect how students are doing, how schools are doing. It includes what our accountability system is going to look like, what low-performing school, what the definition of low-performing is, and how we're going to intervene in struggling schools. So this conversation has been happening for a while. The General Assembly, in their final budget this session, the legislature laid out the specifics of what the plan has to include. So that has caused some tension and dissatisfaction from the state board, specifically at last week's meeting. The board members expressed some concerns about that move, some concerns about the specifics of the plan that the General Assembly is laying out. They were hoping to include some indicators that, such as chronic absenteeism and some other indicators that go past test scores, and it looks like the specifics of the General Assembly's plan are going to rely more on testing.
Because this sounds like another one of those turf wars, this time between the Department of Public Instruction and the General Assembly. So in those cases where we have these turf wars, who wins? The General Assembly?
Yes. So since they passed that legislation, it is law, and the Department of Public Instruction and the State Board is expected to implement that law and carry out that law. Actually, at last week's meeting, Lou Fabrizio, who is a DPI employee and who has played a huge role in developing these draft plans and presenting them to the board and to the public over the last year, kind of said that there are other avenues for the state board and the state superintendent to display their priorities, possibly in the state school report cards or in their strategic plan, but that it's just this year not going to happen in the ESSA plan as they had hoped.
So Tom on Twitter wants us to discuss charter schools. That time has arrived. He says charter schools are public schools. Many are highly qualified teachers. They do the same testing with the same or more rigor. So obviously a fan of charter schools. But on Friday on the News Roundup, Ann, you and I talked briefly about the Thunderbird Prep Charter School. Last summer, the state charter school officials put this school in Cornelius under extra supervision because of concerns about finances and because of parent complaints about building safety and about the school leadership. What have they been doing in the interim to fix these problems?
Well, I would almost say, since we have limited time, to pull back even more from Thunderbird, which is really more an example of something that's happening on a broader scale. If it were just Thunderbird, it would be of concern to a relatively small number of people. But what we've been seeing, and our timing here is good because this is the first day of school for Movement School, which is one of three new charter schools that is opening this month in Charlotte. And so we've seen that over the past few years since they lifted the 100-school cap and said, it's fine, we need more charter schools. And people looked at Charlotte, where we have some long-established and very popular charter schools, and said, look at all the demand there. And so we had a number of schools that submitted plans that said, we'll open with 200 or 300, and within the first 3 to 4 years, we'll expand to 1,000. You know, the numbers vary, but kind of these plans that they would open large and get larger. And in many cases, that has proven difficult to do, because apparently the fact that you're on the waiting list for Lake Norman Charter School, for example, does not necessarily mean you want to go to Thunderbird Prep, which is not very far away. So we've had a number of charter schools that have opened with, I think, good intentions, big promises, often have had some combination of not drawing the students, which means then they don't have nearly as much money to operate as they'd hoped for, often have problems finding or keeping or maintaining a building. If they're serving a challenged population, tend to see the same low test scores that you see in the neighborhood schools that serve these kids. And so we've got a handful of schools that really are kind of on that bubble. And the question becomes, can they find their footing? And that's where we talk about the bureaucracy that you see with CMS. It is big. It is expensive. It also means that when you open a small school, CMS, for example, is opening 5 new schools this year. Most of them are not traditional neighborhood schools. They are small, you know, opening with a few grades, opening with a few students. They can wrap all that around and absorb it. If you're opening a charter school and you find a leader who can't do all of those things
on your own,
and you get in big trouble in that first year. And again, that cycle starts. And exactly as our Tom, I think it was, said, these are public schools, which means that their board meetings are public, that their records are public, that when they get in trouble, we know it and we may report it. And then that becomes a cycle that, you know, the private school may be struggling and you don't know it.
And once again, although they are public schools and they are funded by the same dollars that go to the to CMS, they have fewer restrictions and they have more freedom to operate in innovative ways. And the hope I understood years ago, before all this really got underway, was that we would find out about techniques in the classroom that seemed to work better than had been working in the public schools, and that the public schools would then adopt that and everything would be hunky-dory. Has that proven to be the case?
Liz, do you have any thoughts on that statewide?
So I think that there are some exceptional charter schools. There are some charter schools that are struggling, and it's really a question of accountability. I do think that statewide, the body that those charter schools reports to, the Charter School Advisory Board, who then in turn reports to the State Board of Education, has started to, so they review tons of applications and applications for renewal of charters as well each meeting that they have. And they have started to focus more on the completeness and the rigor of the applications of these charter schools rather than the performance of the leaders that show up. So I think that that's been an important and positive move as far as accountability goes.
And I would say from what I've seen in Charlotte, there's been no lightning bolt revelation from the charter schools. Okay. Often the charter schools serving the kids who do well in public schools, they also do well. There are schools like Sugar Creek, which is working with disadvantaged kids, and they have had exchanges with Charlotte Mecklenburg schools in which CMS teachers have visited Sugar Creek to see what's working. And again, working is relative. It's not a miracle at Sugar Creek, but they are getting some good results there.
But these charter schools seem to be in fairly high demand. Parents want these choices. They want this option. So are they statewide, on average, are they flourishing, or are more of them in trouble because they can't attract or keep either teachers or students?
I think we're still finding that out. Again, we had that 100 school cap for a little over a decade, and so many of these newer schools are in their first, second, third year, and we're still trying to figure out. Sugar Creek, I've said this before on the show, was horrible in its first few years. It came very close to being closed by the state, and it managed to rebuild and stabilize and do some good things. Maybe if there's enough support for all of these schools, they will do the same thing, and 10 years from now, we'll be saying, thank goodness for charter schools.
And by support, you mean what?
Well, that's the interesting question, because it does become who can do that. There are a number of for-profit companies, management companies, and that introduces a whole new wrinkle that some of these troubled schools and two that I wrote about in the past week, that's where they've hit some snags, is that they went to a consultant or a charter management organization, and there have been some questions raised about those. It certainly is expensive. If you only have X amount per student and your whole thing was, yay, we don't have to pay for bureaucracy, but we do have to pay a for-profit or not-for-profit management company, you're kind of back to square one.
So six charter schools in the Charlotte area have failed in recent years. What happens to those students? Do most of them revert back to the public schools? Do the parents take them to another charter school? What happens to those kids?
It's really tough to say. I think in the middle of the year, we actually had three that folded before their year was out and literally closed during the school year. And that's the worst possible outcome, because you do have kids then who are going back, usually, I think, to public schools, who then have to figure out, you know, a kid who's maybe not had very good education during the year, what do you do with them? Our most recent one, community charter school, was a small school in Charlotte. And what I heard was that they were working with a number of other charter schools to get those students transferred
so
for the coming year.
So you're saying that some of these schools are not teaching these kids as well as they might be taught in the public schools? If these schools that have closed have to send their kids to public schools, and the public schools are saying, well, these kids weren't well educated, is that what you're saying?
Sure. I think there are some bad charter schools, as there are some bad district schools and some bad private schools.
Speaking of charters, three new charters are preparing to open. You mentioned one that opens today, but they're preparing to open this month. Around the state, three of the seven charter schools that are opening around the state are opening here.
Right.
In Charlotte. So what are those schools? Movement School opens today. That's 300 K through 2 students, eventually expanding to K through 6.
Right. And it is actually, all of these are somewhat interesting. This is a spinoff from Sugar Creek Charter School, which is a well-established local charter school that we just talked about. Movement doesn't mean it's about dance or exercise or anything. It's actually created by Movement Mortgage Company, which is where the name comes from. So we're going to see, again, whether that Sugar Creek model that has become fairly successful on a small scale can be replicated.
So wait a minute. Movement Mortgage Company runs the school, owns the school? What's the story there?
They're financing it, and there's always a not-for-profit board, and I believe they created the not-for-profit board. They've been working with Sugar Creek back and forth for a number of years, and Sugar Creek, you know, was not saying, woohoo, you know, let's just stamp them out. They really kind of put the brakes on it and said, we don't want to move forward on this until we're pretty sure we can do it well. So that'll be an interesting one to watch.
Okay.
You've also got
And that model has actually that model that you were just talking about with a corporation, you know, financing a charter school, this legislative session, lawmakers have made it clear that they're willing to experiment with some unique approaches to the charter model. One proposal that ended up not seeing the light of day would have reserved 50% of the charter school's enrollment to children of employees of a company that either donates property or a school building or a significant financial or technological contribution.
Okay. Then there are two other charters opening here. Unity Classical, is that right?
Yes.
What is Unity Classical Charter School?
It's affiliated with the Challenge Foundation, which is a national foundation that is encouraging school choice, and it will be the third in Charlotte. And this is not, it's not quite the same as being part of a chain where that's literally the management. It's more support. They use Singapore math. They use some classical education techniques. And they are one of those that they actually had to go and say, we don't think we're going to be able to meet our projections for enrollment. Everything else may be fine, but they're having to scale back a little on size going into it, which sets up potentially that same dynamic.
And then Uproar Leadership Academy is the third.
It is. And it is opening at the site of the failed Crossroads Charter School. It's founded by two young military veterans who describe it as a quasi-military setting. And again, when you're looking for schools, you always have to look at marketing versus reality.
Right.
From what I can tell, it's not terribly military at the moment. They wear uniforms, but they're not military uniforms. They're school uniforms. They'll do character education. Well, most schools do character education. But I do think there is a vision there to eventually turn it into a school with very strong discipline, potentially even boarding school opportunities for some kids.
And as you mentioned, there are four new CMS schools opening this year, and these are kind of boutique schools. They're not major elementary, all-encompassing elementary school. What are they? Are they more like magnet schools, or what are
they? Yeah, and I actually decided it's maybe five. With CMS, okay. There is never a simple answer, including to how many schools. There is Marenkus Middle College High, which is on the Huntersville campus of Central Piedmont Community College.
A school within a school?
Well, it's a school on a college campus, so they attend their high school classes and community college classes at the same time. They can actually stay. You go in 11th grade. You can stay 3 years and leave with an associate's degree, so that's proven popular. This will be the fourth one. There is Charlotte Teacher Early College, which is on the UNC Charlotte campus. Again, is it a totally new school? There was already an early college engineering school there, but this is for students who want to become teachers. God bless them, because they are needed. Opening with 55 ninth graders there. There is the Secondary Montessori Magnet Program, which has been a program at Sedgefield Middle School and now has a permanent home at J.T. Williams, which is one of the schools that was closed amid controversy. It's now reopening. The two newest new ones, Renaissance West STEAM Academy, that's Science, Technology, Engineering, Arts, Math, is going to be a partial magnet, partial neighborhood school where the West Boulevard public housing used to be. This is part of a big community partnership. They thought about working with a charter school and opening their own charter school, and they decided to work with Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools. And Dorothy Vaughn Elementary School, which is a computer coding magnet school in Northeast Charlotte. And if that name doesn't sound familiar, that is the character who was played by Octavia Spencer in Hidden Figures. She was an early woman computer pioneer.
So I have 30 seconds. 30 seconds. Matthew and Boone, could you speak to the required implementation of EdTPA in colleges of education throughout North Carolina? It's an educator teacher performance assessment test certification. 15 seconds.
I can't.
Liz?
I actually have not heard of that teacher certification program either.
Okay. Well,
they got stumped the chump.
we stumped the panel. You get to go back and do a little research, and you'll come back tomorrow as our returning champions. Liz Bell, reporter for Education North Carolina, ednc.org is their website address. And Ann Doss Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Thank you both for the hour.
Thanks so much.